Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Isabel Machado and I'll be your host for this episode, which is part of our new special series, New Books in Celebration Studies. Today I have the pleasure of interviewing a reference in the field, Dr. Jack Santino, who will talk to us about the collection that he edited, Public Performances, Studies in the Carnivalesque and Ritualesque, published by the University Press of Colorado in 2017. Public Performances offers a deep and wide-ranging exploration of relationships among genres of public performance and of the underlying political motivations that they share, illustrating the connections among three themes, the political, the carnivalesque, and the ritualesque. The volume provides rich and comprehensive insight into public performance as an assertion of political power. Jack Santino is professor of folklore and popular culture and has served as the director of the Bowling Green Center for Popular Culture Studies. He was the Alexis de Tocqueville Distinguished Professor at the University of Paris, Sorbonne, 2010-2011. He was a Fulbright Scholar to Northern Ireland and has conducted research in Spain and France. His documentary film on the Pullman Porters, Miles of Smiles, Years of Struggle, received 4 Emmy Awards. His research centers on rituals and celebrations with a particular focus on carnival and political and public ritual as reflective of political, social, and cultural identity. He's the author of numerous books and articles. Jack, welcome to New Books in Celebration Studies.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here, to meet you, to be speaking with you, and I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you. So before we start talking about public performances, could you tell us a bit about yourself and how did you get involved into this particular field and how did this collection come about?
Well, let's see. I'll go back to when I was a child. I was growing up in Boston, Massachusetts, and one of the things in that particular part of the country is the very pronounced four seasons of the year, autumn, winter, spring, and fall in the summer. And each of those is usually celebrated, or they all contain holidays and celebrations that are very seasonally oriented. And I always enjoyed them very much. And I mentioned this, and I start there, because as I grew older and, you know, into my teens, my early 20s, I began to realize that it seemed to me among my peers that at a certain point that you were sort of supposed to outgrow the holidays. It wasn't cool anymore to be very into them. And at some point, I realized that I, in fact, did really enjoy the various traditions and I liked the seasonal connections. And that was something that was very much a part of me. Now, as I continued to age and so on, it took me a little while, but after I graduated from Boston College, and I was out of school for a couple of years, but I had become I continued my interest in various kinds of traditions. And somebody suggested that I should probably go back to school. And I discovered that there were folklore programs, and that was, as probably most of you listeners, it was totally unknown to me. They were serious. You could get a PhD in folklore. And I ended up going to the University of Pennsylvania, got a PhD in folklore and folklife. And from there, I was fortunate to be hired by the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. And they put on an annual public presentation called the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. Now, while I was working in Washington, I began to talk about my various interests. And I did the work that you mentioned on Pullman Porters. I did most of it there as a staff member in the Smithsonian. But I also was talking about Halloween and how I noticed how it was changing and more adults were getting interested in it. And I was approached by a magazine to write an article, and I ended up having an article in Natural History magazine and did a scholarly article and so on. And that led to my writing a book called All Around the Year, Holidays and Celebrations in American Life. While I was at Penn and studying folklore, I took a great many courses in cultural anthropology, and I discovered the works of Victor Turner on ritual. Mm-hmm. And probably, and I know as we talk about carnival, you'll talk about Mikhail Bakhtin, but I would say that discovering the works of Victor Turner was probably the most profound intellectual discovery that shaped my career. I'm kind of going on here, but those things came together. And I took a kind of approach to contemporary celebrations that put into play a lot of the anthropological theory that came out of looking at tribal societies and so on. Well, I got a job teaching full-time in Bowling Green, Ohio at the Bowling Green State University. And while there, had an opportunity to visit Ireland, which I did, and was invited in Northern Ireland, which is part of Great Britain. I was invited to submit a Fulbright application, and I studied Halloween in Northern Ireland, which actually is celebrated, you know, among both advocates of British identity and advocates of Irish identity. So that led to a kind of career in public presentation, public ritual, and how people mark them, mark their traditions as political and as markers of identity. There was great many political public rituals, such as parades and public funerals that had a strong political dimension to them in Ireland. And so I continued to study in Northern Ireland, do research and write, which in turn led to a book on public memorialization of death. And I got teaching invitations in Spain and in Paris at the Sorbonne. And while I was in Paris, and that was about 10 years ago, I attended the various traditional European carnivals in France, you know, pre-Lenten carnivals. And I've been doing that ever since. And along with that, looking at elements, carnivalesque elements in the various street political demonstrations in Paris and in France. And that's sort of where I developed this idea of the ritualesque to accompany the carnivalesque. So that brings you up to date pretty much where I am now.
Yes. And so when we were first started thinking about doing the special series for the New Books Network, I was having a hard time trying to define what I meant by celebration studies. Right, because I think the definition in my head was much broader than what most people thought when they thought about festivities or celebrations. So your book helped me define this And so in a sense, I would like to thank you because I think it inspired the series. But as you note here, the inclusive...
That's very nice to hear. Thank you. Oh. Thank you. I'm sorry, but that's very nice to hear. Go ahead, please.
Well, thank you for this work. But as you mentioned here, you have a very inclusive title, right? We talk about public performances, and it refers to, and I'm quoting you, a number of interrelated genres or types of events that tend to share many characteristics. So could you define public performances and what are some of these characteristics shared by the such different events and experiences discussed in the chapters of this book?
Yeah, as you say, it's broad and it's inclusive, but I'll tell you what I am focused on and what I think about and why. I mentioned that I was working for a long time in Washington, D.C. at the Smithsonian Institution. And I mentioned that while I was at the University of Pennsylvania, that the works of Victor Turner, the anthropologist, on ritual had a very profound effect on my thinking. Well, while I was in Washington at the Smithsonian, our program, our department, was asked by the museum, one of the museums, to put on an exhibition with Victor Turner, who was alive at that point, on ritual festival and celebration. And I was chosen, he was the guest curator, and I was chosen to work with him on putting together live, living demonstrations with different groups of people, demonstrating their various ritual traditions. Now, we put on this brought together artifacts that were in the Smithsonian's holdings, and it was an actual museum exhibition with different objects. And Victor Turner would write the text that the objects, it was broken up into things like rites of passage, seasonal celebrations, and other things such as that. And then he would take objects from all over the world that had to do with, say, birth rituals or had to do with death rituals. And he would juxtapose them, which is something that that makes sense to me. And so coming out of that, I always liked the terminology of ritual, festival, and celebration, again, because it was inclusive. And I think there is a difference, strictly speaking, between, if you want to say this, pure ritual and pure festival, which I take as celebration for its own sake, and pure ritual I take as something that is fully intended to cause, it's not necessarily intended to be festive. It's intended to make a difference. You do it because the religion or the gods or society insist that it be done. So rites of passage, for instance, are necessary to effect change in a person's life from one stage to the next. A baptism is not thought to be just a fun thing to do in Roman Catholicism. It's thought to be necessary in the spiritual life of a child, of a baby. But I say you can ideally separate these two, but festivals and festivity is often used ritually, especially when you talk about seasonal celebrations. They mark a season. They end one season and begin another. American Thanksgiving, is the opening of the Christmas season and this sort of thing. So I like the idea of using inclusive terms. And then I also personally am interested in other kinds of public performances, such as parades or, as it developed into various kinds of ad hoc demonstrations that were ritualized, such as there's a Take Back the Streets movement where people process with candles and so on. You know, so it's very broad in that sense. On the other hand, I'm not somebody who thinks that ritual means any routine or any repeated action. I think it needs to have some conscious sense of transcendence, some reference to the sacred, not necessarily the religious, but the sacred. Now, that said, I say this in a lot of my writing, some rituals are very, very festive. You know, there's hilarity at various Native American rituals, various Jewish rituals. You know, there is a great deal of festivity as a part of a lot of sacred events. And likewise, rituals themselves, sacred rituals, very often form a part or a component of various festivals. If you think of festivals as a period of celebration, so if we think of, say, Christmas season as a festive season, so religious qualities, religious events are a part of it, but so are parties, and so is gift giving, and so are other components. So I thought it best to be inclusive in that regard. But beyond that, I tend to think I personally am less interested in some other kinds of events. If I'm talking about this, it's worth saying also that while I'm very interested in traditional events, I'm interested in tradition in as it exists and as it's used now. So I am very interested in the ways people create or adapt or use emergent, contingent events and respond to events. I mentioned Take Back the Night, where they use ritual ideas such as procession and using candlelit procession, but not in a way that was seen before. We've seen things like it before, but they were used for a very specific purpose now. So if that's at all, if that makes any sense at all, I hope it does. But in terms of the book, I've developed this idea that when I was talking earlier, I said that some festivity is done for its own sake. And often an event like Carnival, for instance, traditional Carnival, is very often meant to be enjoyed at the moment, even if there is inversion, social inversion, a lot of political mockery and satire, parody, gender reversal, all these kinds of things. But it's also understood that when it's over, you go back to everyday life as it existed prior to the event. However, there are also events that contain many of those same qualities, but that are intended to change everyday life. So they're more like ritual than they are like pure festival. In other words, they're using symbolic actions and some symbols generally, but they're doing it to make a change that's permanent, at least in intention. So things like various kinds of demonstrations and, you know, there's a lot of events, political events and so on, that are carnivalesque, but are not carnival. But I think something like, say, Pride Day or, you know, is meant not yet, they're very carnivalesque, a gay pride event, usually in the cities that I've seen them. But they're also intended to have an effect on the participants and the spectators. They're intended to bring people closer together and to get people used to the idea that homosexuality is as much a part of society as heterosexuality. It's intended to make a difference. So I see them as ritualesque in addition to being carnivalesque. So the book, I tried to get events that range from straightforward carnival, traditional carnival, and traditional ritual, and that move increasingly more toward something that is almost entirely ritualesque, such as the gay men's chorale event and things such as that.
So as I mentioned in the beginning, the book deals with the ritualesque, with the carnivalesque, but also with the political dimensions of these events, right? And you say here that these events and actions are always emergent from a social context and are always political in some sense of the world. Could you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, we can use the word political to refer specifically to politics, like currently in the United States with the various election politics. But we also use the word political to talk about social and cultural power relations and sometimes very subtle social and cultural power relations. So various, I mentioned the Take Back the Night. What got me started down that road was going back to Northern Ireland with all the political unrest that existed there. And I started there in the early 90s. And there was, you know, there is violence directed toward Northern Ireland is officially associated with the United Kingdom, and it's officially a part of the British Islands and British culture, and yet it's part of Ireland as well. And it, as a result, there is separatist movements and guerrilla warfare, and sometimes it's more intense than others. And it was fairly intense while I was there. And there were a great many overtly political expressions, like the parades, that for one side or another. However, there are also this phenomenon that we've seen internationally, where when someone dies an untimely death, sudden death of some kind, and very often in Northern Ireland, innocent people were killed as a result of the kind of civil war that existed there. Very often the place where that person died, this untimely death, becomes the site of ritual behavior, where people leave flowers, leave candles, leave notes. And I witnessed a good deal of that while I was there, and I was involved with some people who lost family members. And I was thinking that the difference between ritualizing the place where the person died, this untimely death, and the ritual actions that occur in the cemetery or at home, the difference was, in the first case, they're very public. The I call them spontaneous shrines. The spontaneous shrines, and we see them in other contexts, the roadside cross where someone dies because of a car crash, or other kinds of things like that, they call attention to themselves in very public space. And there's always a dual message. One part of the message is commemoration of the individual who died. But the other part is to condemn the cause of death, whether it was drunk driving or whether it was paramilitary activity or police violence or something along those lines. And that's what gave me this idea that sometimes ritual actions are intended to be political events and meant to be activist events. And from there, I started thinking about how I mentioned earlier, pride celebrations, gay pride celebrations, how they have in their intention, no matter how much festivity, no matter how much fun, there is in the intention a social purpose having to do with the legitimacy of the existence of the people involved in their culture. And even something, I don't know, less controversial, let's say, something like Earth Day. There are events that people come up with to celebrate Earth Day are intended to foster an attitude toward the environment. It's not intended simply to just be a day off or just be fun. So I think that in many, many cases, the use of festivity or fun or ritual or carnival time out of time is an opportunity to engage in activity that is intended to be efficacious. But I think that when we talk about something like saying something like it's always contingent and always political in some sense, I had in mind there just the idea that people are involved with other people. If an example of something where it's not necessarily self-conscious, I mentioned that I've been doing research in France, and I've been looking at traditional carnival. And one of the more traditional, more longstanding winter, late winter, early spring carnivals that I've gotten involved with is in the city of Dunkirk in Northern Ireland, Northern France. And it's very working class. It's not at all, it's not like New Orleans, at least not like downtown New Orleans. And it's not like Venice or Nice, where there are great floats and that the city, you know, it's become a big tourist kind of industry. Dunkirk is largely still, the carnival is the participants, and it's quite, it can be very rowdy, very colorful. There are certain ritualized events. But one of the things I've noticed is that as an outsider, one could say that it's very male-focused. The values, even in this period of inversion and, you know, all the rules go out the window and the people take over the streets and all of that, it's true. But at the same time, like I say, it's rowdy. And you kind of have to get out of people's way if they come plowing through. There are songs that are sung traditionally. And the songs are, to say they're lewd is an understatement. They're incredibly taboo breaking. And men and women sing them happily and all the rest. But when you translate them, and I was there with a woman two years ago, I guess, and she was happily translating them for me. And they involved incest, they involved all sorts of stuff on defecation and so on. And all of them are, you know, the woman talking about how she loves to have sex with her brother and then with her father. And, you know, and I find myself thinking, you know, I don't really see a reversal or a space here in which women take center stage. I'm seeing a different kind of expression of patriarchy or of male dominance. So I think that even in events that aren't intended to have a political end involved, that there are ramifications that need to be or can be examined.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. audible.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That's really fascinating because my previous interview for this series was a book called Carnival is Woman about Carnival in Trinidad. So Carnival can take very different shapes in different parts of the world. So which brings me, I would like to talk about the Carnival section in the book, right? Why are the chapters here? You know, let's talk about the how you organize the book, right? How are these chapters dealing with traditional carnival? And what you say that they look at the social conflict that it embedded in the performances. Could you talk a little bit about carnival?
Yeah, I'd be interested, by the way, in the previous interview, the Trinidad, because one of the I'm interested in following up this idea of woman's place. And I realized what you said was absolutely correct. The carnival takes different shape all over the place. You know, it's a word that refers to a number of different instances. And the difference between European carnival and the carnival in the Americas, you know, in Central and South America is different largely. I mean, the major difference there would be the African presence in the Americas, which is now feeding back into some of the European situations that previous colonial powers, such as like the Notting Hill Carnival in London. And I'm seeing it in France as well. But how organized it? Well, we had the article by historian Sam Kinzer, and he talked about, he compared a European with, an early modern Nuremberg European event with the more contemporary event that he himself has been involved with, I guess, in Trinidad himself for quite some time. And how legitimate those kinds of broad comparisons can be, I'm not quite sure. But it was an interesting approach. And Roger Abrams talked about something I mentioned 2 seconds ago, which was the whole African basis of American carnival. The idea that from New Orleans south, you have this Afro-Caribbean carnival. And his thesis, and it's not just his, is, well, let me back up a little bit. The idea that Africans in the New World obviously come in largely as enslaved people, and they have very specific and particular history, unlike the Europeans. And so when there were periods of celebration permitted to Africans, they were according to the work calendar, but all of which in turn was based on the Christian calendar. So in other words, days off might come around Christmas and Easter and times such as those. So then they were limited freedom to celebrate in their own ways. The white Europeans would look at what they did and say, okay, well, that's their carnival celebration, but it was kind of an imposition of our terms. So there's some schools of thought that think that the African dimension to American celebration, which derives from various African masquerades, usually those masquerades were done in ritual context, rites of passage and so on, that we're interpreting them according to white Europeans were interpreting them according to their understandings, but they might have been very different. That said, the theory was that in the African-derived events, such as the Mardi Gras Indians in New Orleans, which, again, you find throughout in one way or another. There are wild Indians and other kinds of things in the Caribbean and down into South America. Roger's idea was that there's a dimension of conflict that is being expressed and enacted in all of these. Whereas with the European style, it's literally, we're not working, we're celebrating. And we can mock authority, but it's not the same thing as different groups, different crews, or different tribes, or whatever, as they're called in different Black contexts, and the ways in which those embody a kind of conflict because of a different situation that those individuals find themselves in. So I wanted to begin simply with, like I said, with something that's straightforward carnival or straightforward ritual, rather than then say it's more difficult for some people to understand what this term would mean if it's, you know, if I'm already using sort of exceptions to it. So that was the theory for bringing those two placing them in positions of a kind of privilege to introduce the book. And then I think the next article was Beverly Stoci and with the political dimension of carnival and or ritual. And I just wanted a kind of theoretical statement up front that says, you know, we can look at these different kinds of events and see that they perform different social and cultural tasks.
You sort of mentioned this, right, you were talking about this idea of doing comparative studies. But we have here different case studies of parades and processions in very different parts of the world that take very different shapes. And could you comment on what do you think are some of the advantages and possible shortcomings when we, you know, look at similar events in different places and contexts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that first of all, I think parades are interesting because when you use the word parade, most people have simply a sense that they're intended to be fun and that they're a spectacle that you go to watch and enjoy yourself. And the terminologies that we're using throughout are words such as ritual that and festival that people use every day, and they use it in different ways. So it is important, I think, to define terms. But one of the things I like to say is all parades are not created equal. And what I mean by that, and if you don't mind, let me give you an example. I'm speaking to you from where I live now and work, Bowling Green, Ohio. And they have here in November something they call the Holiday Parade. And in fact, it's entirely a Christmas parade. But it's done usually in the middle of November, before Thanksgiving. And the purpose of that is to say we're kicking off the Christmas season, and the various, it goes up and down Main Street in town, and all the stores contribute, and because they want to increase holiday sale. And there's very little about that that is not obvious. The various components of the parade are both local and communal. That is, their high school band, marching band from the area, and local churches, but also local department stores. And they put on some interesting, you know, displays, but they're also usually giving out coupons to the bystanders and, of course, tossing candy to the kids along the side and so forth. And I remember I was it's a well attended event. It's got a lot of positive social qualities that brings the community together. People see each other and say hello and talk and so on. I'm not putting that down. But I was also there one time with a member, a fellow professor who was in the sciences, and a lot of on campus of the university I teach. And a lot of the scientists can be very skeptical of the kinds of studies that people like me do. And this one person was very arrogant, turned to me and he said, "Ha, I'll bet for you this is doing research going to this." So I said to him, I said, "Okay, look, first of all, there's a great deal of literature on parades." I said, "Let's think about it this way. Who gets to parade? Who gets Main Street? Who gets the traffic stop and police protection? And what is in that parade? And who is the most, who's got the most obvious and elaborate float? Just the departments do it." And like I say, there's a lot good to it. But all of these department stores, even the churches, were giving out literature as they walked down. All of them are essentially advertising themselves. And all of them were trying to build up constituencies and bring people to spend money. I said, now, compare it to, I mean, even in the same town, there's a Memorial Day parade. And it's much, much smaller. It has far fewer, a much smaller audience. And it just, it's very short because it's very much a military event. And while people are very respectful, there's not this commercial quality to it. Still, it's Main Street and police and traffic lights. But if you start thinking about other kinds of processions, if you start thinking about parades and other kinds of ways, I've been to peace marches, anti-war marches, and so on, and they very often aren't allowed on the street. They can only walk down the sidewalk. They don't change the traffic pattern, so the people doing it get broken up. And I've been in situations where the police are there, but they don't act, they're not providing a great deal of protection against counter protesters and so on. So I say again, different parades have different qualities. And the ones that we take for granted, such as the Macy's Parade at Thanksgiving or national parades at 4th of July, all of those are reinforcing our central normalized ideologies of both capitalism and of nationalism. And I went on to talk about in Northern Ireland how parades, some people will die over not allowing a parade through its neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And some people will kill over insisting that a parade can go through any public street. I said, there are people willing to kill, people willing to die for the parades in Northern Ireland. For a long time in Belfast, you could celebrate what people like to refer to. They'd say the Protestant parades of July the 12th. They were all day. They were in all six counties. They took over Center City, Belfast. But there wouldn't be that same kind of activity on the Catholic St. Patrick's Day. They weren't allowed to parade in Center City, Belfast, on the basis that it could cause unrest. They could only do it in certain neighborhoods and so on. So there's much more to be said about parades than first meets the eye. So I say that in just in general, that in any of these genres, usually what's interesting to me and to you and to probably our listeners is not always articulated in the parade. They instead are seen simply as harmless spectacles and fun. But in reality, you know, they can be of very serious importance. So we have a couple of the articles on some of those politically, the dimensions, both in Ireland, which is historical, and the Puerto Rican Day parade in New York, which is obviously, again, all about ethnic identity. And also I wanted, that was an article about flags, so I wanted to bring flags into it as well, because you can get very, you know, specific on components, but flags have all those same dimensions that parades in generally do. You know, they're carrying a symbol, and people can get very, very concerned about even, you know, taking an American flag and making it a rainbow flag, or turning it into, now there's talk of the thin blue line on the American flag, or the Confederate flag, that controversy in the United States. So all of these things, as I say, on the surface are pretty straightforward, but a lot lurks underneath.
Yeah, it's very reassuring to hear you say all that, because in very informal situations, when people ask me, what do you study? And I say celebrations, I get very suspicious looks. Sort of like, oh, you go have fun. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I'll tell you, I mean, that never goes away. I did a presentation on campus once on the Northern Ireland material. And as I said, I mean, I'm talking about material, and it was always I did the parades, I did what I called my spontaneous shrines. I had interviews with people that I played who had lost family members, and they break your heart. You know, they would break your heart. And I would, and the presentations always are very well received. But the person who was in charge of the presentation, even after hearing it, then said, well, Jack studies celebrations, you know, woo-hoo, lots of fun. And I thought to myself, I just showed you how, you know, I mean, it's frustrating that when people hear those words, that's how they'll respond to it. And it's very difficult to get people to believe that what you're dealing with is, it's fun to do it, because for me, fun is being deeply engaged in what I am interested in. Mm-hmm. But it's not, you know, it's not just mindless entertainment, not at all. So, yeah, but I mean, it's very, very frustrating to people just don't understand what it is that we're all about.
Yeah. So this brings me to a section in the book that really resonated with me, is the section on carnivals of grief. You sort of mentioned it, but could you tell us a little bit about that, and how or if you see it reflected in this current wave of protests against systematic racism and police brutality?
Yes, I do see it reflected in this current wave of protest. And I've been very interested and fascinated by this current wave, both for its own reasons, because of the issues involved. I did go to a Black Lives Matter event here in town in June, I guess it was, shortly after the events in Minneapolis. And the police handled it pretty well. I mean, the police took a knee, and the police captain, and you know, they presented themselves, at least, because there was a point when some of the, and they were pretty much, I think, student leaders, but they met on the lawn in front of the police headquarters, and there was a police superintendent, and the mayor, when challenged, took a knee, and they seemed to be very respectful, which I thought was a very encouraging sign. But there were then the various speeches on this little village green. And, you know, as I have been in other situations, but I was just struck with just how deeply emotional the speakers were, and how deep-seated the anger and the frustration was on their part. And I think it's very moving. To go back a little bit with the term Carnival of Grief, I was, there was, are you familiar at all? I think I referred to it in that essay. In Paris, there's a satirical, they were just in the news too this week. There's a satirical newspaper and it's called Charlie Hebdo. And, it's full. I mean, it's what people would call politically incorrect. And in fact, it's very uncomfortable. It's all cartoons, but they're full of racial stereotype. If there's, Jewish stereotypes, visually, Arab stereotypes, a lot of anti-Catholicism. So a lot of, priests with altar boys and this kind of, based on the, various scandals in the Catholic Church of, priests molesting, children. So it touches on all those things, but it does them with drawings that can be difficult to support. So at some point, I guess they do a lot of, there's a lot of, concern in France and in Paris about, the North African immigrants. So they're usually, marginalized and ghettoized. And also they tend to be, Muslim. And there was a lot of, they would draw a lot of Muslim stereotypes and so on, including renditions of the Prophet Muhammad, which is forbidden, as I understand it, in Islam to do a rendition of the human form. And they did it as an in-your-face kind of, no one's going to tell us that we can't do this. So they hit a lot of caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad. And then it was a February, 5 or so years ago, I guess, when two or three men broke into the Charlie Hebdo headquarters and just opened fire on the cartoonists and various people, and several people were killed. And it was a very, very shocking act of urban terrorism. And the entire world responded. It was a major event. Well, about a few weeks later, I happened to be in Paris, I think for Carnival, in fact, I had gone over. And I thought, I should go by the Charlie Hebdo headquarters and see what kind of response they had, because I had written about this idea of spontaneous shrines, and I wanted to see what was going on. In fact, I'll be even more specific. I had gone, Paris is trying to rejuvenate a carnival that had pretty much petered out by the end of the 19th century. And I had attended that, and I knew some of the people involved. And it was pretty much just a parade that ended at a certain plaza in Place de la République. When I got to this plaza, it was full of graffiti and that was responding to the Charlie Hebdo murders, and people were laying wreaths and people were writing on the plaza itself and so on. So I thought, okay, this is pretty amazing. And I went off to Charlie Hebdo headquarters, which was still under guard by soldiers and so on. But at the nearest intersection is the place where people were leaving. They had created a spontaneous shrine, and it was quite a large one. It was actually in 3 or 4 corners of this intersection. And I find these things overwhelming. I find them very, very moving. And people were there, and people were lighting candles and so on. And I have photographs of this on my Facebook page, by the way, of all of these things that I'm referring to. But as I was reading it, reading the messages, looking at the offerings and so on, I found myself thinking, I feel like I need to write about this because it's so powerful. But I've already written on spontaneous shrines. I have a book called Spontaneous Shrines and the Public Memorialization of Death. And I thought to myself, do I have anything left to say about it? However, at the same time, as I just told you, I had been to Carnival. I had been to a symposium, colloquium on Carnival. And that was in my mind. And somebody, and I don't remember who, all right, let's just say it this way. I've heard carnival defined as an excess of signifiers. And that's jargonistic. But I thought that, you know, if you go to a carnival, it's there's music and there's dance and there's costume and there's food and there's drink and there's movement. It's an excess of all of those things all at once. Festival generally has all that quality of being, you know, multiple genres and so on. So there's that sense of an excess of input. And I thought, here I am looking at this, and these are material. This is material culture that people have left, materialization of emotion, if you will. But it was an excess of signifiers. I mean, you know, there was piles of notes and wreaths and candles, and some of the, because it was seen as Arabs, they were Jewish responses to it, and there were a lot of drawings and cartoons because they were cartoonists who had died, and on and on. And I thought to myself, well, it's an excess of signifiers, but it's not carnival as such. But because carnival is usually something we think of as fun, as positive, but I thought to myself that it is an overwhelming expression of grief and grievance. So I came up with that thought, and I still am not sure whether it's the best terminology, but carnival of grief. But when I watch and see the various kinds of things that are happening as we speak in the United States, and since the killing of George Floyd, and the subsequent various violent acts that have happened, I found myself again thinking and wanting to suggest the concept of a carnival of grief. But again, I hesitate, or grievance, grief and grievance. I hesitate simply because I don't know if carnival is an appropriate word there. The other night, and you might, I'd like to hear your response on this. I don't know if you saw it, but this past week, both Trump and Biden went to Kenosha, Wisconsin, and Biden met with the family and the various local community members of the man who had been shot 7 times in the back. And there was this clip I saw of a young woman who spoke in a church to the candidate, Joe Biden. And she said, I'm just going to speak from my heart now. She said, there's so much heavy anger. People are heavily angry and people are hurting. And I thought to myself, this term here, again, I wanted to suggest to her, it was like carnival grief, that it's an inversion of what we usually think carnival is. So that's the best I can do in trying to explain what I mean by that. But that's how it came about. And it's something I think about.
Yes, and I think we need a term for it. And I agree with you that people might be confused when they hear the word carnival associated right with grief. But there is something happening, and we need to try to understand and put it into some terms that we can make sense of. But the both visits from yes. both candidates seemed there was a performative, a public performance element to it, very different. The people they decided to meet, the visual material culture associated with all of that. Yes, it's really something we need to think more about. Go ahead, please.
No, I was going to agree with you. And you used the word performative there, and I appreciate that because I haven't used it yet, but it is something going all the way back to the early stuff with my Northern Ireland materials and the spontaneous shrines, that they were performative, meaning not just that they were, you have to perform them. There is that. You have to parade. You know, you have to actually perform it. But the idea also that they are intended to make some kind of a statement and so on. And yeah, I think if you examine those two events as performance in Kenosha this past week, it's obvious that they're intended for different audiences. They're intended to make totally different statements and so on. So I actually appreciate your feedback on that, because you're right. I too think that terminology is important, and it's good to have words that actually mean something, that aren't just, you know, jargon, that seem to answer a need to describe something that hasn't been articulated yet in the scholarship or in the literature.
Well, this has been amazing. So, but I would like to conclude our interview with a couple of questions, if it's okay with you, about books and projects. So could you recommend any other book to our listeners who may want to learn a little bit more about this subject after they read the book we just talked about?
Well, you know, I think that, honestly, and this goes back a ways, but I think that I mentioned that the work of Victor Turner on ritual was profoundly important to me. I think, and there's a collection of his essays called The Forest of Symbols. Now, that, you know, I think it was published and might have been published in the late 60s. So it doesn't address issues of politics and power and gender and race and so on the way the more contemporary literature does. But I think it analyzes and gets at the properties of ritual and symbols better than anyone else has done. And he also edited a book. There is a book that came out from the Smithsonian called Celebration, A World of, oh no, it's called Celebration, Studies in Festivity and Ritual. And that edited by Victor Turner. And again, that's probably in the 70s, but it's a very good collection. More recently, you know, the hour's gone by, I guess, but we didn't mention Bakhtin particularly, but the concept of Carnivalesque comes from the work of Mikhail Bakhtin and his studies of Rabelais, the French author, excuse me, and his construction of the idea of Carnivalesque has been profoundly influential, and that's something that people should be aware of. I don't know. I don't want to toot my own horn. You've mentioned the, we're talking today about the book, Public Performances, which, you know, coming back again to terminology, I decided to use the phrase public performances simply because I was going to be wide range over ritual, festival, and public display and try to pull in a variety of different kinds of things. But I'd like to mention this book, small book that I wrote on the Northern Irish materials, and it's called Signs of War and Peace. And then I forget the subtitle, like Social Conflict in Northern Ireland. But that's really, I think, where a lot of what came later in my thinking derived from. So I'd like to mention that. And, you know, there is so much now. I think there is developing a kind of field of, you know, you're working and I'm working with the Journal of Festive Studies. And we see that these different terms, sometimes it's festive studies, sometimes it's ritual studies, sometimes it's people just doing carnival, but people are reading the same literature. They're reading historians, they're reading anthropologists, they're reading cultural studies work, folklorist, and so on. And I do think there's coalescing a kind of field there. And quite possibly this Journal of Festival Studies could serve as kind of a central organ for that kind of material.
Yeah, I'm particularly excited about the interdisciplinarity of the material that we're receiving. Yeah. And We need to find a more cohesive term, because sometimes, as you said, we say celebration studies, festive studies, but I absolutely agree with you that there's a field emerging here, and people are thinking similar things, but we're starting to find each other. So that's important.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. Yeah, I think we're starting to find each other.
Do you have any new projects on the works? Anything that you're thinking about working on?
Well, what I'm thinking about working on, in some ways, COVID, the current confinement has set me back, because I haven't been able to go back over to Europe at all. Canceled a couple of conference appearances and so on. But I'm still developing some of the ideas we've talked about, where I've been looking at some of the French Carnival. I've been thinking about the women in the role of women. I have an article forthcoming in a book. The book is forthcoming. It's not mine. Somebody else edited. But it's on the Women's March of 2017. And I have an article on that. And which again, something that was very carnival-esque, but wasn't carnival. And I was looking specifically at the Washington, D.C. March, even though it was all over the country and all over the world. And that's what I was in Dunkirk, when I've been in Dunkirk, being hosted by a married woman with two kids and so on. I found myself thinking, this carnival is not the kind of statement that the Women's March is, and the imagery isn't the same. And so I'm curious about some of those ideas. And also, this idea of Carnival of Grief, I'm still, in your comments now, have got me thinking maybe it's something I should pursue a little more deeply, because we're seeing it this summer. We're seeing a great deal of it. And, I'm working on developing new ideas is where I am right now.
Well, Jack, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm happy to do it anytime. And I like to listen to the podcast as they come out, because it is something, like you say, we're finding each other. And the more the more communication that exists, the better. So I appreciate you reaching out to me. To do this interview. It's something I'm happy to do.
And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to this episode of New Books in Celebration Studies, until we find a different title for it, a new special series for the New Books Network. I just spoke to Jack Santino about the collection that he edited, Public Performances, Studies in the Carnivalesque and Ritualesque, published by the University Press of Colorado in 2017. I'm Isabel Machado, and until next time.